This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You may have heard about telomeres. They're the little protective caps at the end of DNA, and these telomeres get shorter and shorter with age. Scientists use the length of these caps to give you a biological age. There's even a personal genomics company out there that claims to tell you, well, how well you're aging through your telomeres, what your telomere age is. But there's one animal that might be able to reverse this process. My next guest is here with news of the animal that holds the key to this genetic fountain of youth, along with other selected short subjects in science. Amy Nordstrom is an associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum. She's here in our CUNY studios. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks, Ira.
Did you have a good holiday?
I had a great one.
That's great. Let's talk about, so what animals work out, you know, what are we talking about that's reversing?
Well, the edible dormouse, it turns out.
The what?
The edible dormouse, so named because apparently the Romans used to keep these in clay pots and fatten them up with nuts in order to eat them. A little tiny rodent found in the Western European region. These guys have the remarkable ability to actually lengthen their telomeres over time. There's a study out of Vienna from the University of Veterinary Medicine there. Researchers put 130 nest boxes out in the woods and tested cheek swabs from these edible dormice over the course of 3 years to measure their telomere length over that time. They actually found that the telomeres shorten for the first couple years of the mice's life, just like they do in most animals. But between the ages of 6 and 9, the telomeres actually lengthen, which is very unusual. So this is the first time they think that anybody has observed such a phenomenon in the wild.
And do we have any idea why they're able to do this?
We don't really know, but they have a theory, and that theory is that the edible dormice have an interesting reproductive strategy where they do not reproduce in years when the food supply is low, and this probably leads them to reproduce later in life than the average rodent, and that's a problem because reproduction is also known to shorten your telomeres. So they might have evolved a strategy by which they can actually lengthen their telomeres at a time when they would otherwise be vulnerable with age and with late reproduction to actually having them shorten. So this might be a strategy that helps them preserve their telomeres condition over time. And it seems to be working. The dormice can live up to 13 years old.
13?
Right.
And a regular mouse is much shorter than that.
Yeah, just a few years, maybe 2 or 3, maybe four. So it's a pretty remarkable extension of their lifespan.
Now, I know because we've done stories about the naked mole rat. It's not as cute, but it can live up to 30 years. Do you know with the naked mole rat if that's a similar type of thing going on there?
Well, the naked mole rat has a couple different strategies that it uses for such a long lifespan. So for one, it lives underground almost all the time. So it's immune to predators and being found by them. Another thing is that it seems to really not be so subject to cancer. And many, many mice die from cancer, almost all of them. So the mole rat has perhaps evolved a strategy to prevent dying from cancer, and some scientists have suggested that it expresses a certain gene whereby the cells in the naked mole rat can kind of sense when they're overcrowding themselves and stop replicating, and that's key to preventing cancer, they think, because obviously cell replication getting out of control is something that leads to cancer in mice and other animals.
Interesting. Let's go to another subject. I know that you visited a company that is working to develop wireless broadband, not cellular phones, something different.
That's right. This is something different. So it's like the broadband internet that you get at home on your laptop or your desktop, hopefully. This is a company called Starry, based out of Boston, Massachusetts. And they've been experimenting since the start of this year with a really innovative way to deliver broadband internet. You know, usually we have to go out and dig up a bunch of streets and, you know, install these fiber optic cables under buildings to pipe internet service to people's homes for these high speeds that we want with broadband. But Starry thinks that they can do it over the air through base stations, kind of similar to what you would have seen in a cellular network.
So like on a cell tower, you'd have one of these transmitters.
Right, exactly. One of Starry's proprietary kind of custom-built base stations. And then they have a particularly interesting way of receiving internet. So they ask customers to install an antenna outside their window that captures the signal and brings it into their homes. They're using here high-frequency millimeter waves, which are a section of the spectrum that really hasn't been used before for anything else. There's a lot of extra bandwidth. And if they can pull it off, this could be a much cheaper way to deliver really fast internet.
So we're talking about a pilot program right now in Boston?
Right now, they have only installed one base station. I went up and saw it on the roof of a data center.
N equals one.
Right. But they hope to expand that trial to maybe a half dozen sites by, you know, middle of next year and sign up some beta customers in the Boston area. And then they've applied for licenses from the FCC to do more tests in about 14 different cities across the U.S., including Chicago, Denver, Seattle, and L.A.
And this is the head of this company is the guy who created Aero, right, to disrupt cable TV. But the Supreme Court said,
It's the same guy.
Same guy.
And so he shouldn't run into the same exact challenges in this case. You know, the TV broadcasters, cable providers were asking him to pay licensing fees for the content that he was rebroadcasting. In this case, he'll just, you know, he's just hoping to send internet signal. But he will face competition. There's a lot of other companies, including Verizon and AT&T, that are hoping to do a similar thing. So it's good that they're already in beta because the competition's going to heat up.
Yeah, the big guys come in. And your last story puts a twist on the saying, cat got your tongue? This is interesting about cats.
Absolutely. You know, cats are highly evolved creatures if you think about it. I mean, their paws are suited to helping them, you know, creep around very quietly. They have this remarkable ability to twist themselves around in the air when they're falling and so that they can land on their feet. And it turns out their tongues are also highly evolved to help them with grooming, which is something that they spend about 50% of their waking hours doing. So I talked with a PhD candidate at the Georgia Institute of Technology, Alexis Noel, who's been looking into this matter of cat tongues and how they're so well adapted to grooming. And she describes these spikes, keratin spikes, that are on the surface of their tongue. These spikes lay flat most of the time, but the cats have the ability to flex their tongue in such a way that they pop up when they start to groom. And the spikes are curved on the end so that when they pull them through a tangle in their fur, they can actually pull out that tangle pretty effectively.
Sounds like Velcro. Like their tongues are made out of, you know, one side of the Velcro pad.
It is. It's really remarkable. A very effective grooming technique. And there's, you know, 200 or 300 of these spikes on any cat's tongue. So it's pretty high density. And, you know, the strategy of laying them flat and keeping them out of the way the rest of the time is a pretty clever one.
You know, but it would also explain why cats get so many hairballs, because they're so good. These spikes really pull the stuff.
Right. I mean, that's the hazard of having basically a hairbrush on your tongue is there, you know, there are the hairs that get stuck in their mouth. And the next step for Alexis will be she's trying to actually figure out what goes on in the cat's mouth when those spikes lay flat. She thinks that's when the hairs, you know, slide down the back of the cat's throat. But it's, you know, it's tough to get inside the mouth of a cat. It's hard to put a video camera in there. So she's going to look into trying to use some X-ray technology to figure out what's going on inside of those cats' mouths.
They do have a mind of their own.
They're notoriously difficult test subjects. It's really hard to get a cat to do what you want it to do.
We'll stay tuned and see what happens.
Absolutely.
I guess you can't try this at home. So, Amy Nordstrom, thank you.
Thank you.
Amy is associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum right here in New York. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. As winter approaches, I'll bet some of you are shopping right now for some new winter boots. And if so, you might be happy to know that the Toronto Rehabilitation Institute has come up with a rating system to test the slip resistance of 98 different types of winter boots based on how they performed against icy conditions, simulated in their state-of-the-art winter lab. What you won't be happy to know is what they've discovered when they tested them. Barry Westhead is Director of Research Engineering at the Toronto Rehabilitation Institute, and he joins us via Skype. Barry, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Thanks for having me here.
Why did you start testing winter boots for slip resistance?
Well, as a rehabilitation hospital, we're obligated to and mandated to prevent injuries. Part of our work is to restore people who have disabilities from injuries or disabilities, but we also, as a research division, have a high mandate to reduce injuries. And we've been working with the shoe industry because one of the major healthcare issues is slips and falls on ice in winter. Yeah. Up here in Ontario, where we have a population of about 15 million, we get 21,000 visits a year to hospital beds due to slips on ice.
I lived in Buffalo, so I know what the weather is like. Let's start with the bad news. When you tested these boots, what did you find?
Well, unfortunately, we tested over 100 boots, and only 9 of them passed.
Say that again. You tested 100 boots?
100 boots and only 9 passed.
Wow. Tell us why that was. What was about the good boots? The bad news. What's the good news? Why did the good boots pass?
The good news is that there are some new technologies, and we were aware these were on the market now, and so we could finally begin to raise public awareness to the fact that some boots could be better than others. And so there is two technologies that perform very well. One is called a green diamond technology, and that involves taking a hot sole, boot sole, and sprinkling granules of silicon dioxide onto it, and then covering it with a thin layer of rubber and sanding off some of the rubber so that the crystals are exposed. So you have a rubber sole with crystals protruding through it.
So you basically made cleats, or they made cleats on these boots, right?
Yeah, very small cleats, that's right.
And the other boot that worked?
The other technology is even more high-tech. It's a soft rubber compound that has a combination of micro grooves. It's the softness of the rubber and the micro grooves that are cut into it. And also embedded in the rubber are glass fibers. And these glass fibers create basically, again, like little grippers. So when you rub your hand on the material, it feels a little rough, like fiberglass. And they do a great job of gripping on ice.
Well, are the other 90 makers of the boots looking at this and saying, hey, maybe we should try this?
Yes, they are. And a lot of the retailers are very responsible and no doubt disappointed that their boots didn't make it this year. But the technology is there it will be available next year. And I'm sure that the entire footwear landscape for winter footwear will look quite a bit different next year, and that was our intent.
Well, that's great. Good to hear that you're making progress there, because you know there's not much that can hold on to ice. So
that's right. That's right.
Thank you, Barry. Barry Westhead is Director of Research Engineering at the Toronto, or as they say up there, Toronto Rehabilitation Institute. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, our picks for the best science books of 2016. Stay with us. We'd like to know what you think they are. We have our own panel of experts, so don't go away. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. Welcome back to our program. I want you to know that we are very happy to begin our actual, you know, book review of it, of the season. Nothing says holiday season like a best of list, and am I right? It's our end of the year tradition to share the best science books we read this year. And there were some great ones. We talk a lot about books on Science Friday, and this year was a bumper crop, everything from climate change to the microbiome to profiles of women in science to, well, the small things like the meaning of the universe. Small topic. That one really got us thinking, just as any good science book should. What about you? Which of this year's science books spoke to you? Give us a call, 844-724-8255. And you can also tweet us at SciFry. Joining me to recap some of the best science books of the year are two recurring guests. Maria Popova is editor and founder of the website brainpickings.org, and Lee Billings, editor at Scientific American. Welcome back. Good to see you.
So wonderful to be here.
Would you agree that it was a good year for science books, Maria?
It's a very strong year.
Yeah? Let's start off with your top pick. What would you recommend?
Without a doubt, one of the most beautiful, most interesting books I've ever read is Black Hole Blues and Other Songs from Outer Space by cosmologist and novelist Jan Levin, who you've had on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the story of the century-long vision originated by Einstein and half-century-long experimental quest to detect a gravitational wave, to hear the sound of space-time. But one of the extraordinary things about the book is that it was written before LIGO made the historic detection. So it's not the story of the triumph, it's the story of the climb, and it's really a larger story of the human spirit and its tenacity and why scientists do what they do, why they devote entire lives to pursuits strewn with unimaginable obstacles and constant failure, and do it anyway.
Yeah, it's great when you learn about the process and the people.
The people.
In the book.
Well, and I think, you know, Dr. Levin is in a very unique position to tell this story because she's a working scientist who studies black holes. That's her bread and butter. But she's also an award-winning novelist. Mm-hmm. And so she writes so beautifully with kind of Dostoevskian insight into the character of these people. And you come to see that the genius and the foibles are just completely interwoven in the fabric of their personhood. And that science is just such a profoundly human endeavor.
And she had the bonus of actually being there when they made that discovery.
Yes.
And added it onto the book. Lee, you recommended a trilogy of books that aren't by the same author.
Oh, that's right.
What's the connection?
Well, they're all about the Anthropocene, this idea that humanity is becoming a global geological force that can control the fate of the planet. And so the three books are The Unnatural World by David Biello, The Planet Remade by Oliver Morden, and Earth in Human Hands by David Grinspoon. They all offer three different views on the Anthropocene. The Unnatural World by David Biello, a former colleague of mine and friend, I should say, is kind of giving a ground truth look at how the planet's changing, some of the key players involved at high policy levels and just street levels that are helping some of these changes come about or combating them in some cases. He's traveled around the world to do that. So he's traveled to Beijing. He's traveled to other parts of China and all over the South Polar Seas, crazy places.
Yeah.
The other two books, Oliver Morden's book is actually from 2015. I'm sorry that I kind of slip it in. But it didn't get enough credit, I think, when it first came out. It is the most authoritative book that I've read about geoengineering. Oliver Morden is a journalist in Britain who's spent, I think, more than a decade researching this problem about how we could control the climate in the future. And he gets really deep into policy and talks about weird situations like it's really not that cheap to do some of these things, some of these big experiments with the climate. You could imagine an individual billionaire or a rogue nation doing that, and kind of scary. So he gets real deep into policy. The final one, David Grinspoon's Earth in Human Hands, is from a more astrobiological perspective because he's an astrobiologist. And so he's talking about the potential cosmic implications of the Anthropocene, of a sentient species taking control of its planet. What does that look like in the far future? And does that have implications for our search for life elsewhere, for instance? Could it be that something like the Anthropocene is going to last longer than hundreds or thousands of years and, you know, maybe stretch into hundreds of millions or billions of years?
Let's hope we're still here.
I hope so.
For what we're doing with the Anthropocene. Maria, people are looking for a book to enjoy with their kids.
I have one that ties into what Lee was saying in terms of the relationship between humanity and our planet. It's a wonderful book by the British artist Jenny Desmond, who's a Maurice Sendak fellow, and it's called The Polar Bear. It's part of a nonfiction series that she's doing. Last year in this end-of-year review, we included The Blue Whale, which was her first one. And now comes The Polar Bear, which is the life and world and science of one of our planet's most vulnerable creatures. But it came out right around the election, so it's very interesting to think about, you know, now that we can't count on politicians to advance science and to protect the planet and to educate the next generation about responsibility. It falls on us, it falls on parents, on educators, and this really wonderful book is just such a wonderful tool for that.
Interesting. 844-724-8255. Yeah, there are a lot of things that it looks like we're going to have to do on our own. Let's go to Kenai, Alaska. Kathy, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you?
Hey there. Go ahead. Thank you.
I love your program. I listen to NPR all the time, and the book I'm interested in is Hidden Figures, which I believe you spoke about a couple of weeks ago on your program.
What did you like? What did you like, Kathy, about it so much?
Well, I'm a math geek myself, but I'm also very interested in the history of women in mathematics and science. And I haven't yet been able to get the book. I just ordered it for my dad for Christmas, but I'm anxious to read it myself. Yeah. I think it sounds fascinating.
That's great. Maybe we have a couple of other suggestions we could add on to that. Let me, Maria?
Yeah, I think that book fits into a series that came out this year. Another one that is, and the Hidden Figures is about the black women mathematicians who helped put people on the moon, basically, and during the space race. Almost a century before that, we have these women working at the Harvard Observatory, who are known as the Harvard Computers. And their story is told in a book called The Glass Universe by Dava Sobel, which comes out next week on Tuesday.
You know about it already.
And hey, yeah, she might appear on the show at some point.
Yeah, she will. We've already booked it.
Wonderful.
It's a preview.
But these were women who were making astronomical discoveries 40 years before they were allowed to vote. And some of these discoveries we still use today to classify stars. And they were the foundation for how Hubble figured out that the universe is expanding. On the basis of these women's work. And it's a really wonderful story that paved the way for women in science.
Lee, do you have any comments?
Other than I Well, Maria's taken several of my also other favorites that that I figured she could handle more than I could. But I think those are also some great topics. One book I did want to talk about was actually, I brought it into the studio so you could see it yourself. It's called Spaceborne by Donald Pettit. He's a former astronaut who spent a lot of time in the International Space Station. And what's special about this book is he's not just an astronaut, he's also a photographer. And he's taken, I think, some of the most iconic, the best photos you're ever going to see from the space station.
We're going to have him on next week.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, funny thing about Don, though, is that he technically cannot promote the book. As a federal employee of NASA, he technically cannot promote the book itself. So he's going to have to talk about the photography.
Who knows
what
this new administration will be able to promote.
Yes.
But vested interests.
Truly gorgeous book, though, and the story of how he took these photos is phenomenal. It really gives you a new view into the space station and also into our planet.
Yeah, that is, and he's a wonderful speaker. We've actually talked to him from when he was up in space. So
nice.
He's a funny guy. Okay, let's move on to your next selection, Maria. Both of you picked "Black Hole Blues" by Jan Levin, as you said. You brought a passage from Levin's book to read to us.
I'll also add that, you know, I think there are three kinds of science writers. There are explainers, who are the kinds of people that write textbooks. There are elucidators, who do more than inform and kind of illuminate the connections between things, and most popular science books are that. And then there are enchanters, who really take us to these higher orders of meaning with beautiful prose, and that's what I'm reading. It comes in the context of, she's talking about how gravitational astronomy is opening new landscapes of possibility, because everything we know about the universe comes so far from sight, and now we're beginning to listen. And this is what she writes. She says, in the hopefully plentiful years that follow a first detection, the aspiration is for Earth-based observatories to record the sounds of cataclysmic astronomical events from many directions and from varied distances. Scientists will reconstruct a clanging, discordant score to accompany the silent movie humanity has compiled of the history of the universe from still images of the sky, a series of frozen snapshots captured over the past 400 years since Galileo first pointed a crude telescope at the sun. 5 decades after the experimental ambition began, we're on the eve of the crash of a colossal machine into a wisp of a sound, an idea sparked in the 1960s, a thought experiment, an amusing haiku, is now a thing of metal and glass.
Very nice. Very nice.
And before the detection, before the wisp of sound.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go for another suggestion to the phones to Hallandale Beach, Florida. Elijah, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey there.
Hey there, go ahead.
The book that I suggest is I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and A Grander View of Life by Ed Young.
One of our favorite subjects, the microbiome. Lee, you want to talk about that? Do you agree with him?
Well, I do agree with him. However, I should say that due to having a very young son at home who takes up all my time, I have not yet read I Contain Multitudes. I haven't been getting a multitude of sleep. So I think actually we should probably turn that to Maria, because I think she has read it.
That's on my list, actually. Yeah. It's a wonderful book that's completely worthy of its Walt Whitman reference of the title. And Ed Young, who's one of the most capable science storytellers and communicators and journalists today, basically looks at how the microbiome is related to everything from mental health to even free will. It's absolutely fascinating.
Wow, yeah, it's a great book. It's a great book. Ali, we have a lot of listeners who like bird watching.
Oh.
And for them, I know you recommend The Genius of Birds by Jennifer Ackerman. Why?
Because it's an appreciation not only of, you know, birds, obviously, if you like birds, but it's kind of giving you a deeper appreciation of non-human intelligence. It's really casting doubt on this view we've had for a long time that we're somehow special and unique in our ability to reason and make sense of the world. And I'm not saying that that birds are as smart as people, but maybe bird brain isn't as much of a slur as we think it should be. So she's traveled around to all kinds of places, New Caledonia, an island off Australia, to look at crows who build tools. She's looked at things like pigeons in New Jersey or jays in Virginia that can do things like distinguish between an impressionist and a cubist painting. There's lots of other examples, bird song being similar to language, their ability to remember locations and find them across thousands of miles, their flocking behavior, their social intelligence, the way they can tell sometimes the emotional tenor of their partners. Mm. These are all things that we've seen in birds. And Jennifer does a really, really good job of explaining not only how we're finding more and more of these behaviors, but also connecting it to their natural history, the way that, you know, birds are really just dinosaurs with feathers. And they don't even have cortexes like we do. So it's a They're bird brains are strange, yes.
We're finding out they're smaller than we are, smarter than we are.
So speaking of non-human intelligence, there's a wonderful book by Alexandra Horowitz, who's the head of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard. It's called Being a Dog. And it's about how dogs perceive a completely different version of reality than we do. And although some of it is biologically wired, a lot of it is learned. So it's really about how we can learn to use our smell, kind of learn from dogs to swing open the doors of our own perception.
Yeah, that's everybody loves dogs.
In New York, especially.
Pigeons, not so much.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Here with Maria Popova and Lee Billings, talking about our favorite books this year. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Berkeley, California. Hi. Well, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, am I on?
Yeah, you're on.
Hi, Ira. I love your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to share some books that I've been giving to my nieces and nephews, and it's a book for kids and young adults called Dr. Bonafide, and it teaches the kids about their anatomy. It's like a workbook. It's colorful, it's instructional, it's participatory, and even adults love to do it and work with them because it really brings a lot of knowledge to understanding themselves, and the graphics and activities are just engaging. And what's so unique about this is that the bones are actually outlined in topography, so the actual name of the bone is on the outlined. And I know that my nieces and nephews have loved it. So it's called Dr. Bonafide, and it's by a company called Know Yourself, and it's awesome.
Yeah. Thanks for that suggestion. Are you familiar with it?
No, it sounds wonderful, but it made me think of another book for kids and young adults that's in the vein of Women in Science. It's called Women in Science by Rachel Ignatovsky, who's an illustrator, and it's a lovely illustrated encyclopedia of pioneering women in science, you know, people like Vera Rubin, who confirmed the existence of dark matter, and Lise Meitner, who discovered nuclear fission, Jocelyn Bell, who discovered pulsars, Katherine Johnson, who helped put people on the moon. You know, she's one of the figures in Hidden Figures. It's just a lovely kind of light companion to Hidden Figures in the Glass Universe.
Speaking of women, we have a tweet from Emil Volchek who says, recommend Lab Girl by Hope Jahren. Are you familiar with that, Lee?
I'm familiar. It's another one that's on my to-read list. I've heard very, very good things about this memoir of Hope's experiences, basically working in a lab and trying to balance being, just being an average person. Yeah. Well, not an average person. Above average person, I think, with you know, a lot of the strange demands that are rather unique when I think you're a woman in science.
Right. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to South Dakota. Hi, Brad. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Hey, how are you?
I'm wonderful. I'm on Interstate 90. I read several books this year that were really good. They're kind of the some of the history of technology. I'm an engineer by education. I'm a retired electrical engineer. But the one that I was wanted to mention in particular was a book called Pinpoint, and it's about the history of the GPS system and how far that's come and how it's reached into places way further than anybody ever dreamed of, just you know, location purposes. To the point of it used for timing of stock market trades and things like that. Very interesting book and the history of that.
Yeah, we're familiar with that one. Thanks for recommending that. Yeah, the history of GPS is fascinating.
And it's a favorite example that scientists use when people say, well, what's the use of so-and-so? And, you know, GPS comes from Einstein's relativity.
Right. We don't have to talk about Tang anymore coming out of the space race.
But speaking of relativity, another one of my favorite books both this year and of all time is Time Travel by James Gleick, who's an icon of, you know, historian of science, wonderful writer, very similar to Jan Eleven in just the lyrical quality of the prose, and it's about the history of why we think about time travel and why we're so troubled by its directionality. So it pulls on relativity theory and the history of science. It pulls a lot on philosophy, but it's really a literary book. So a lot of Borges, a lot of using literature as a cross-pollinator of science and philosophy to ask this larger question of our relationship with time and how it factors into our consciousness.
Time's very popular now in entertainment, the movies, film, a lot of time people talking about the time, which is my segue to say we have to take a break. So we'll be right back in about 30 seconds. Stay with us. We're talking about books with Maria Popova, editor and founder of the website brainpickings.org, and Lee Billings, editor at Scientific American. Our number, a lot of phone calls today, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be back with more books after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're recapping the best science books of 2016 with Maria Popova of brainpickings.org and Lee Billings, editor at Scientific American, and welcoming your phone calls, 844-724-8255. Also, your tweet at SciFry. Let me go through some of the tweets that have been coming in. Lots of people have tweeted this. I recommend Overview, aerial photographs to help us see Earth and human impact from a new perspective by Alexa Quinn. She suggested that. Nikki says Embryo, Science and Sentient Beings. Gigi says I recommend Teresa Bondora's The Periodic Table of Elements coloring book for middle school and high school students. Great tool, she says. Also, Katie Howe says for the younger bookworms, I'm recommending Ruth Spiro's new Baby Loves Quarks and Baby Loves Aerospace Engineering.
That's a smart baby there.
I'll bet it is. Speaking of smart, let's talk about Sean Carroll.
Yeah, right? Of course, Sean Carroll is a physicist who has written a really great book called The Big Picture. And it's a rather, in some ways, a typical physics book. You could say it's two books in one. One is just kind of giving you the standard explanation about how we know things we know about the universe, how the universe works. In particular, he has this idea of what's called the core theory, which is him saying that quantum field theory can be used to explain essentially everything in our everyday life. So maybe not, you know, the pulsations of a neutron star very far away, but anything you're ever going to encounter in your life, quantum field theory explains. And then he uses that to dismiss things like the afterlife, telekinesis, psychic powers, astrology, so on and so forth. But it's not just that. So he kind of extrapolates from there. He jumps off from there, from the idea that we live in this meaningless universe that's incomprehensible and we're just specks of dust that mean nothing in it, to more philosophy, where he's saying, well, can we draw some sort of philosophy and way to live our lives and way to derive meaning from the universe from this meaningless state we find from science? And of course, he says the answer is yes. It's kind of a softer, gentler, more fuzzy version of the new atheism in some ways that you heard from folks like Hitchens and Dawkins and so on and so forth. But yeah, very, very solid book. I really adored it. And it's even
he's
if
a
you
great
don't
writer.
If you don't agree with him, you still can find the areas of disagreement and those sorts of finding where you disagree with them, I think, really can clarify your own views about the universe and about philosophy.
Yeah,
that book was also on my list, and I especially love what he calls poetic realism, which is this, you know, if the universe is meaningless, how do we synthesize meaning in the act of living and thinking? It's a very kind of humanistic notion.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Amber. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you so much for taking my question. I love your show.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So I have a 13-year-old son who is an advanced reader, and he wants to grow up to be a quantum physicist. And on his Christmas list, he asked for books about black holes and the universe, and I was looking for suggestions for him.
Yeah. A lot of books there. Let me start on the left and move to the other side of the table. Thanks for calling, Amber.
Sure. Well, you know, if we want to go for one that's a little less heavy-hitting, or I shouldn't say heavy-hitting, but maybe a little easier to digest and read than Sean Carroll's, which is a very weighty, thick tome and also ideologically loaded, I would suggest going with Carlo Rovelli's Seven Brief Lessons on Physics. He's another theoretical physicist, and he published a series of columns in an Italian newspaper that was then condensed into this book, distilled into this book. It's only 78 pages, and it covers general relativity, quantum mechanics, the structure of the cosmos, elementary particles, quantum gravity, probability thermodynamics, and our place in all of it, right? Only in 78 pages. You can read this
thing.
And
easy to understand stuff.
Easy to understand, yeah. So I would recommend it for pretty much any reader.
I would say Black Hole Blues is very much enjoyable for any kind of reader. There's also another book called Mapping the Heavens by Priyama Vera Natarajan, who's a younger scientist who studies black holes and dark matter. But if you're able to find, there's an out-of-print book from 1991 by a CERN physicist called Alice in Quantum Land, and it's an allegory of quantum physics using Alice in Wonderland as the template. It's a wonderful book.
You know, that reminds me of a book that I started reading when I was a kid that got me a lot of interested in science, and that was George Gamow, the physicist.
Oh, yes.
Gamow.
Yes.
And he used to write about relativity, and I think he had a Mr. Tompkins series.
Yes,
yes.
Remember
oh,
that one?
They were so wonderful.
It was a serial in one of the New York magazines, like the New Yorker or something like that. And then he put them all together into a book.
Mr. Tompkins makes many cameos in James Gleick's time travel.
Great, but I mean, find it online somewhere or out of print. But it's for the basic knowledge about relativity. It's about a guy who lives in a world where relativity comes to life. So he explains what's going on around him. I love it when scientists are able to do that.
And not many are.
Yeah. Let's go. Let's see if we can go to the phones. Let's go to Jack in Alexandria, Minnesota. Hi there.
Hi. I'd like to suggest Dark Matter by Blake Crouch.
Hmm.
Well, if you guys have heard that, it just came out, I think, in July of this year. And it's about a physicist who just is living his normal life with a wife and kid, and teaches at a tier two college in Chicago, and then is one day abducted. And it turns out, as you get into the book, that I won't spoil it all, but he's abducted by himself from another universe, and it explores the theory of the multiverse in a very compelling and gripping novel.
Wow.
Yeah. So his other self that comes and visits him developed a box that you can enter, and you take this drug that allows you to see infinite number of doors inside the box.
Yeah, we did this book. This was quite an interesting science fiction book. Yeah, thanks for calling. It reminded me of a play on Broadway that actually was, I can't think of the name. It's not playing anymore, but the director or the writer actually had people sitting on different universes at the same time. They would read their lines a little bit differently. The next line, I just heard that, but no, it was sort of recreating what a parallel universe would be, a multiverse. Mm. Gyllenhaal was in that thing. It was a good play. I can't remember it, of course, because I have to recall it. But it seems from what we're hearing, a lot of people are interested in physics. A lot of physics books are being suggested, whether it's black holes or multiverses or it's quantum mechanics.
I think we maybe just had a bumper crop this year of really solid physics writing, and maybe we always do every year, but I feel like something about this year, there were just a bumper crop of good physics books, so it's just a random fluctuation, I think, maybe.
But I also think, the zeitgeist is always fomented by events, cultural events, and we cannot discount the fact that the LIGO discovery, which is a physics discovery, is one of the most important discoveries ever made in the history of science. Of course, the popular imagination is going to be captivated by that and kind of fertilize the field.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how we're now, as I said before, we're now seeing more popular culture, whether films or plays or whatever, picking up on this theme about science being very popular.
But I would say, in a way, it's sometimes to the detriment of another branch of science, which is social science, and we have not done a very good job of giving social science the respect that it deserves. And to that end, a social science book on my list called The Confidence Game by Maria Konnikova, who writes about...
She's great.
She's wonderful. We get mixed up a lot because of her names, which I always take as a compliment because she's a wonderful writer, wonderful thinker. She writes for The New Yorker about psychology. And this book is about cons and why they work on intelligent, well-intentioned people. So she kind of debunks the myth through 50 years of research and through profiles of some of the greatest con artists in the world, the myth that somehow only stupid or inferior people are susceptible. And, it's interesting in the context of, in a culture where masses of normal people have been swayed to ideologies based on fraudulent claims, what that is, what human psychology that exploits.
Mm-hmm. And in the short minutes I've got, do you have a last pick, Lee?
I'm going to go with The Age of M by Robin Hanson, a George Mason University economist. It's his first book. It's called Age of M, E-M. M stands for emulated brain. It's the idea that in the future, maybe 100 years from now, we could actually upload people's consciousnesses and virtualize consciousness. It's a wild idea, but what's so nice about this kind of science fictional idea and this treatment in this book, which is, I have to say, very fun but very tough to get through because it's a very detailed book, is how rigorous it is. Hanson really goes through all of the possible implications for what this means for the economy, for human behavior, for sex, love, death, architecture. Goes through it all. And it's one of these things where, again, maybe you don't agree with everything he says, but when you figure out where you disagree, you come to interesting insights. And, you know, who knows? In the future, maybe our uploaded ancestors will see him as a prophet. I'm not really sure, but it's a great, great read. Dizzying with ideas.
I'll bet. Well, that's been great. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Time flies, doesn't
it? My pleasure. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Maria Popova, founder of the website brainpickings.org, and Lee Billings, editor at Scientific American. And if you couldn't keep up with the fast pace of our book picks, we have them up on our website at sciencefriday.com/books. And now we explore the fate of Cassini and Juno, two different outer solar system missions, both trying to do big things this year. On Wednesday, Cassini began a new stage in its mission to Saturn. Over the next few months, the orbiter will get closer to Saturn's rings than ever before. And then it's going to dive between the rings and the planet to sample the atmosphere, all culminating in September on a suicide mission, crashing into Saturn. And that will be the end of Cassini, which launched in 1997. We caught up this week with Cassini project scientist Linda Spilker. She has been part of the team since the late 1980s.
Cassini's kind of gotten to be like a friend. You know, we watch as, you know, she flies around the planet and getting ready to dive between the rings and Saturn. You know, so there's a little bit of like that sense of loss.
And a much younger mission, the Juno orbiter, arrived at Jupiter in July and has already collected data that's changing scientists' understanding of its unique magnetosphere. But the mission has experienced some technical difficulties this fall. Juno is still in a long 53-day orbit rather than the intended 14-day science orbit that would allow more frequent data collection. Here to talk about what's next for both missions is Dr. James Green, Director of Planetary Sciences at NASA. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thanks so very much. It's really exciting to be able to talk about these two fantastic missions.
Before we go to you, here's Dr. Spilker talking about the final plan for Cassini next September.
We're going to be continuously sending data back until the very last second when the atmosphere gets thick enough that it just turns our antenna away from the Earth. And it will be more like, imagine a giant, you know, like a meteor coming into the atmosphere of the Earth. We're going to be at 75,000 miles an hour. We're going really, really fast. You know, the spacecraft will probably be, you know, torn apart, and those pieces will probably, you know, melt or vaporize. And then the little bits of Cassini, you know, these little bits that we've sent from the Earth will become, you know, part of Saturn. So down to the atom level, basically.
Dr. Spilker talking about the final plan for Cassini on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Not to forget that James Green, Dr. Green, is here with us. He's director of the Planetary Sciences at NASA. Are these Dr. Green, are these sad times when the missions are over?
They are, you know, but it's really bittersweet for the simple reason both these missions are making so many observations that are so unique and important. Things like understanding what the real mass of the rings are at Saturn and looking into the cloud structure and finding where the origin of its magnetic field is. While at the same time, Juno was doing that at Jupiter, is looking deep into the planet, finding where the water layer is and how much water the planet may have gathered at its early creation, which tells us where it might have actually accreted and started from. Because we now know these giant planets are in different locations today than when they were really created. So these are just fantastic opportunities for us to learn really new things. But indeed, at the end of Cassini's last orbit, it'll be very low on fuel, if not, you know, just the vapors left. And so we're going to ditch it. But we'll learn a lot all the way down, as Linda says, into the depths of Saturn until it's crushed and dissolved.
Wow. I'm getting all misty just thinking about that. And Juno was supposed to enter a more science-friendly orbit last month, but it didn't. What happened there?
Well, on its path, as we were getting ready, it had a what we now know is a software anomaly on board. This got it confused, and when that happens, it goes to a normal state, and that is a we call a safe mode. And because it's in safe mode, then it went through the pass normal, but didn't have any of the instruments on. Now, as it went back out away from Jupiter in its very long orbit, in its out to the Apogee, which is at a great distance, it gave us time to really figure out what's going on, find out how the software collided inside the spacecraft, and then create the patch, upload it, test it, and now we're ready to go, because on December 11th, we're going to go shooting through the close passage again, right over the tops of the clouds at Perigeux.
Have we learned, what have we learned so far on this mission?
Oh, all kinds of things. You know, this is a new and unique view. And from the cameras, we see a completely different cloud structure than Cassini sees at Saturn in the northern and southern hemispheres. You know, we see far more cyclonic things at Jupiter, whereas at Saturn, we see this hexagon, this more of a regular structure in its jet stream, so to speak, in its upper atmosphere. We also observe the magnetic field at high resolution so close to the planet that it tells us this planet, Jupiter, has a very complicated current system. And in fact, there may be several different types of currents that are arising inside it that create its very large and complicated magnetic field. In addition to that, we go right through the auroral zone and we look at those particles that are precipitating, coming down, being accelerated out of the magnetosphere and hammering into the atmosphere, glowing that atmosphere so we can see these spectacular auroras. Gives us an idea of their temperature, their densities, the types in terms of whether they're electrons, protons, all the masses. And we really can tease out some of these processes that are occurring in the magnetospheres.
Dr. Green, thank you for taking time to be with us. We'll be watching forward. Dr. James Green, Director of NASA Planetary Science Division. A couple of last things before we go. Speaking of space, remember that weird star that was in the news earlier this year, the one with the spooky, potentially alien dips in brightness? Researchers are now searching for signs of intelligent life coming from that star. It's a long shot, but if they actually find something, what then? Read about it at sciencefriday.com/aliens. Charles Berquist is our director. Senior producers are Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler, Luke Roskin, our video producer, Rich Kim, our technical director, and Jack Horowitz and Sarah Fishman, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And that play I couldn't remember before, Mark Mazadourian tweeted, "It's Constellations. How could I forget that?" I'm Ira Flatow in New York.